I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today I'm joined on the show by journalist James Henry, who's currently working for the organization WhoWhatWhy.com and has been recently investigating the Boston Marathon bombing. After an injury ended his career in the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning trade, he went back to college to get a degree in communication with a lot of focus on media studies. The insights he gained into how public opinion is formed and manipulated by the news, entertainment, advertising, and public relations industries profoundly affected the way he viewed the world. He began to see how it was possible for the government and media to lead a nation into a bloody war under false pretenses. More specifically, how the news media failed to question what they were being told by interested government agents and instead joined in beating the drums of war. And since much of what he learned had essentially ruined his ability to pursue a job in the mainstream communications industry, he was lucky to come across Russ Baker's Who, What, Why, which is not afraid to resist the herd mentality and ask the uncomfortable questions. Having grown up in Massachusetts and having family connections to Boston, he was deeply disturbed by the marathon bombing and felt compelled to reach out to Russ about a series of problems he was seeing with the official version of events. He was asked to join the team doing research for the site and soon began writing his own articles. James Henry, welcome to the show.
Hi, Cheryl. It's good to speak with you.
You've been doing some research with Russ Baker at Who, What, Why on the Boston Marathon bombing that occurred on April 15th, 2013. Can you just refresh our memory a little bit what the official story is regarding the Boston Marathon bombing?
Sure. So generally, their brothers, both Tamerlan and Johar, are accused of placing backpacks individually near the finish line of the Boston Marathon. They're both accused of detonating those bombs, and they claim to have no idea who these people were, and they had to dig through all thousands and thousands of digital photography to zero in on a couple of suspects. And they said publicly that at least Johar is seen dropping his bag, but they've been sort of strangely mum on exactly what proof they have as to Tamerlan's role in dropping the bag, that is. So then days went on. It was days of media speculation. Nobody really knew what to expect. And the government zeroed in on who the suspects were. And it's Thursday the 18th, 3 days after the bombing, at about 5:30 p.m., the FBI did a press conference where they showed pictures of the two suspects. This is the infamous white hat and black hat photographs that were sort of grainy and hard to see exactly who they were. But the story is that the brothers recognized that they were wanted, and they gathered up a pistol and a machete and BB guns or whatever that would be good for. And then they apparently decided they need more weaponry, according to the government. So they went to MIT and shot and killed Officer Sean Collier while sitting in his cruiser. There were, of course, differing accounts of how that all went down, but we can get into that later. They then tried to steal his weapons, apparently were unsuccessful, so they abandoned the effort and decided to drive over to the Alston neighborhood of Boston, where they carjacked the anonymous Danny. So he's the Chinese student from Northeastern who's an entrepreneur who said the brothers tapped on his window, showed him a gun, said they wanted his car, they wanted money, and then they drove to Watertown with the carjacking victim, Danny, where they retrieved items out of the brothers were driving a green Honda Civic at the time when they did the carjack. So Tamerlan got in the car with the carjacking victim. Johar followed behind with the green Honda Civic. They drove to Watertown, retrieved items out of the Honda Civic, put them in the carjacking victim's Mercedes SUV. They both ATM, forced the carjacking victim to take out, I think, $800 out of his bank account, and they then realized the Mercedes SUV was low on gas. So this is where they allegedly drove into a Shell station on Memorial Drive in Cambridge, and Jahar went out to pump the gas, realized it was a cash only where he had to go inside and pay, which you'd think they would have done anyway since they'd just taken $800 from the gentleman's bank account. But anyways, Jahar went in to pay for gas. Tamerlan stayed in the car with the carjacking victim. And while Tamerlan was allegedly fiddling with a GPS device, the carjacking victim, Danny, made a daring escape, ran across the street to a mobile station, screaming and yelling to the clerk in there that he's been carjacked, that people were trying to kill him, and that he hid in the back room. So long story short on that, carjacking victim Danny called the police from the mobile station, and he told them both that he had left his iPhone in the car and that it had Mercedes tracking. So it's not really clear how they actually tracked the vehicle, but it was supposed to be one of those two methods. The car was tracked to Watertown, where a uniformed police officer driving his cruiser spotted the vehicle described in the Bolo, be on the lookout. He started to follow them, did not turn on his lights, and this is where, allegedly, Tamerlan jumps out of the vehicle and just starts unloading his pistol into the police officer's cruiser. The cruiser backed off and called for backup. Other police responded, and a big infamous shootout ensued right on Laurel Street near the corner of Dexter Avenue. And one of the neighbors happened to get some photos of it, went all over the internet. Very grainy, hard to say exactly who they are, but they do generally appear to be the brothers. And then the older brother, Tamerlan, who apparently was the one holding the gun, also during this shootout, I should say, somebody, one of the brothers, threw some sort of explosive. They're alleged to have thrown an explosive at the police. It blew up in the middle of the street. And then Tamerlan was sort of taken from the side. A police officer had come around from a backyard, started shooting at him from the side. Tamerlan turned, started shooting at him. His gun jammed, threw a gun at the officer, turned around and started charging the other officers off the street, and he was tackled from behind by the officer who had been shooting at him from the side. The younger brother allegedly jumps in the SUV, turns it around, and while trying to blast through the police barricade, runs over his brother, who's being apprehended in the middle of the street, speeds down to Slough Street and abandons the vehicle there. Somehow he got away from the police. Then into the next evening, he was on the run, hiding in a boat, a dry dock boat in somebody's yard, and the neighbor found that something was amiss with the tarp covering his boat, looked inside, saw blood, saw a figure, backed out, called the police. So as you can imagine, this area was swarmed with probably hundreds of law enforcement with itchy trigger fingers at that point, and despite the fact that Jahar did not have a gun, but of gunfire erupted, the brother was ultimately apprehended. It turned out he did not have a gun. From that point on, he was brought to jail, and that was essentially the official turn of events.
So where does it begin to fall apart? I know in your research you said that the witness, Danny, who had the car that was supposedly hijacked, it sounds like we don't even know who he is. We don't know his name. Nobody's met him but a few reporters, according to some of the articles I read on your site. Could you talk about that?
Sure. That was one of the most troubling aspects right up front. Was most people were very open about who they were, and particularly victims, and this one in particular wanted to remain anonymous. And what's so crucial to him is the fact that allegedly the older brother said to him, "I am the Boston bomber, and I just killed a cop." Right off the bat, decided to admit all of these incriminating things to a victim that they were supposedly just wanted money from. So his existence is critical to the story. But the problem with his account is that he had interviews with about three different journalists face-to-face, and in three different, or four, actually, maybe even a fifth, but the most high-profile were three major ones, and there were differing accounts of what he said on key details to these journalists. Now, most of this is chalked up by your average person as well. It's just media confusion. The media always gets things wrong, but the point is, the journalists would probably not miss these key details about how you escaped, and this was where the story kept changing. When he initially spoke with a New Hampshire affiliate who interviewed him face-to-face, told him that he had simply been let go, that the brothers were done with him, they got his money, and they said, see you later, get out of here, whatever the case was. And he ran off and told the police what happened. Then, days later, he was interviewed by a reporter of the Boston Globe alongside a criminologist from Northeastern who sort of was alongside of him. It was just a little bit odd that he had to bring somebody along with him to this interview. The long story short is the escape story suddenly changed from I was let go to I escaped while they weren't looking. And he also said that the brother had been in the car with him, or that both brothers were in the car. Neither one of them had ever gotten out. The key fact is he said one brother was still in the car with him while the other brother went inside. And then in another account, when he spoke with another journalist, he told yet another version, one brother was in the car fiddling with a GPS, and the third version is they both got out of the car. One of them was pumping the gas while the other one went inside to get stuff, snacks, or whatever the case was. So we have three different versions of events, and it just brings into serious question what it is he's saying.
Right, and I think the part that is interesting to me is that we don't know his identity. And I know that he was interviewed by a John Miller, and in one of the articles I read on the Who, What, Why website, it says that John Miller was actually went from being a journalist to working for the government intelligence community. And maybe you could talk a little bit about those connections.
Well, we don't really have anything clear and factual on that other than exactly what you just said, is that it is troubling for a gentleman like John Miller, who so easily eases in and out of journalism and then national security, clear conflicts of interest there. He has connections to the world that he should be scrutinizing and probably loyalties, you know, like most people in any profession. You know, he claims that he can ethically skirt that divide without any trouble, but it certainly raises questions about whether or not he's going to ask tough questions of people feeding him information anonymously, or some of his colleagues may be feeding him the information, and he's not going to challenge them. So,
yeah, there's a clear conflict of interest there for him, because I think it said at the time he was a spokesman for the FBI Office of National Intelligence, which oversees the CIA and the FBI. So clearly a journalist with some ties to the intelligence community.
Yeah, and just to add one more thing to that, there are other shadowy characters around this couple of young men. You know, the uncle was married to the daughter of Graham Fuller, high up in the CIA. Obviously not anything direct, but it certainly raises questions about how they were brought to the country and what the circumstances were. And even the mysterious college professor that said he gave Jahar lessons in his Chechen background, which is innocuous, but at the same time, that makes you wonder about connections to the Central Intelligence Agency and all of the national security implications working around the region they hail from.
Right, and I understand that the older brother, Tamerlan, was on the U.S. watch list since 2011, and he gets to go overseas and back and forth. And in the beginning, they said they had no contact, they didn't know who he was, and then they had to admit that they did. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's exactly one of the big red flag thoughts, is that they weren't very forthcoming about knowing who these characters were. And then Russia pipes up, hey, wait a minute, we sent you warnings back in 2011, do you remember? And then, oh, yes, well, we investigated it, but it turned out it was no big deal. We were concerned for his civil liberties, so we didn't investigate further. You know, as we know, with the FBI has been following Muslim people around the country, it's kind of a stretch of the imagination to think that they were overly concerned with his civil rights.
Right. So we have this witness, Danny, the eyewitness who said that the brother confessed that they had done the job and murdered the police officer. We don't know Danny's real name, and only a few select people in the media have had a chance to interview him, one being this John Miller, who has connections to the CIA, FBI, or the intelligence community. And then there were several articles I read on your website about witnesses being intimidated by the FBI. Can you talk a bit about that? What's happening to the witnesses and friends of these two brothers?
Sure, and just generally on that, it's troubling to see that this is such a slam-dunk, open-and-shut case. It's kind of strange that they're going to such extreme lengths to try to silence any opposition or anybody that could possibly support the defendant in this mess. That right there is troubling. But
yeah.
So what happened down in Florida is especially troubling, how a friend of Tamerlan, Ibrahim Odishev, he was followed around for weeks by the FBI overtly. He knew they were watching him, someone could argue, to the point of harassment. And it appears that they were ratcheting up the pressure on this individual. They were well aware that he had a violent history with martial arts expert that was very trained in mixed martial arts and probably had been advised that he had an explosive temper. And so with all that said, they do this marathon interview with him in his hot apartment. And instead of doing it in a secure area, there's swords on the walls, there's coffee tables, there's all this potential problematic stuff where this person who allegedly has a hot temper, they're ratcheting up the pressure on him, and then all of a sudden, apparently, he flips out, and it ends with his death. So, I mean, that is extremely troubling. The FBI agent who pulled the trigger, come to find out, has a history of questionable behavior in Oakland, as a police officer, and then mysteriously gets a job with the FBI after having left Oakland on disability. So, That's another strange situation raising flags.
Wasn't this Ibrahim Todashev shot in the head 7 times?
He was. He was shot in the top of the head, and I'm not exactly sure about the specifics of where the bullets hit him. I know there are serious questions about the body positioning and how he was shot, you know, whether or not he was trying to get away or whether he was charging the police officer. There are questions about. I've not been a particular area that I'm well-versed in.
Okay. This Mr. Todashev had a girlfriend, and I understand they harassed her. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, she was detained, questioned, and she had actually been contacted by a reporter from Boston Magazine. She did an interview with one of their reporters, and she raised a lot of questions about whether or not her boyfriend had even been in Watertown during the triple murder for which she was being questioned at the time of being shot. She disclosed the level of harassment that has been happening with the FBI with her dead boyfriend. And soon thereafter, she was visited by the FBI. She was brought in. She was detained for a length of time and ultimately deported for, you know, having nothing to do with Boston Marathon bombing. She was deported on a very questionable justification. But it had the appearance of, after having spoken to the media and raising any sort of questions, legitimate or otherwise, he was silenced by being sent out of the country. And that happens to be the case with a lot of the other individuals connected to the Sarnam. Most of them are not American citizens and are extremely vulnerable to deportation. There was a friend of Ibrahim Todashev who had left the country to go to a family function in Central Asia. When he tried to come back, he was not allowed back in the country. And again, he had been one who spoke to the media and raised a few questions about the means and the method by which the FBI questioned his friend. So he was persona non grata, not left back into the country. It's just a series of individuals that had nothing to do with the bombing, not accused of having anything to do with the bombing, but the fact is they could potentially have information about the legitimacy of what the government is saying, and they just don't want trouble, so they're just sending people out of country.
Yeah, weren't they also closing their bank accounts and that sort of thing to harass them?
Yeah, there is an article on the website about it, whowhatwhy.com, where one of the writers for Who What Why discovers that Beauty Care, which is the Islamic organization, advocacy organization, they have discovered that some of their members have had their bank accounts mysteriously closed by banks who basically have the right to shut your account for no particular reason, and these people just also happen to be connected to friends of Tamerlan and or Ibrahim Todashev.
Interesting. What's the impact all this having on the upcoming trial? I guess it's going to start in January for Johar?
It does. It starts in January. You know, understandably, emotions are running high right now. I don't know if you've seen any of the clips on the news about the little showdown at the courthouse there between supporters, quote-unquote, of Zahar Tsarnaev versus one of the victims. But understandably, emotions are running high. There's been a political correctness climate has developed in Boston about questioning anything about the government's version of events is anathema to sacrilege or un-American or downright lunacy. So it unfortunately devolved into a black and white kind of situation in that regard. Yeah, the trial is coming up fast. We're sifting through court documents as fast as we can, trying to see if the mainstream press is reporting what they should be reporting in there. And we've picked out a few interesting items in there, like specifically that early on the government was claiming they had forensic evidence that Amerlin was involved in triple murder, and then come to find out when the younger brother asked for the evidence, or when his lawyers did, they said, well, there is no evidence he participated in the murder other than Todishev's alleged confession, which even that is questionable. When Ibrahim Todishev was shot dead, just prior to that, he had confessed that he and Amerlin participated in the triple murder in Waltham. That's what he was being questioned about.
And we only know that from the FBI who were there and killed him.
Exactly. There is one thing to that. The only other witness to that crime was the girlfriend of one of the three murder victims in Waltham. She walked in the door and saw the crime scene, and what she saw did not exactly match the way Ibrahim Todishev said to the FBI it had happened. So,
Again,
there's some questions about the legitimacy of his alleged confession.
Right, and so you just wrote a recent article about how the prosecution had to admit that they didn't have evidence for these slayings. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it speaks to a tendency we've seen in this from the beginning, and it is anonymous law enforcement leaks that early on are picked up by the media. They're widely disseminated, and in every instance, they have a sort of a damning effect that, okay, yes, look, this brother, there's mounting evidence, one of the articles says, that he was involved in the crime in Waltham. The government has forensic evidence, and this comes around as, okay, well, yes, it's quite plausible that this person committed the murder. But then later on, in court documents, we see that that was actually false, that they, other than a confession that made by a man who was clearly under duress and got shot to death, other than that confession, the government then later admits quietly that they do not have much evidence or forensic. So it's a pattern we've been seeing that when everyone's paying attention, there's a series of law enforcement leaks that get picked up, spread around by the mainstream media, and then later on, the evidence turns out to be dubious at best or non-existent at worst. So that's essentially what that article's about. It's bumped to the second page by now. I'm on the whowhatwhy.com website. It'll be retrieved by typing in Barnett Evidence or Boston Marathon, and all the articles on the topic will come up.
Okay, great. Yeah, and again, the website is whowhatwhy.com. So we have an eyewitness that we don't know. His name is Danny. We have another confession by Todishev, who's dead. The evidence they have is really kind of questionable, correct?
Well, it's hard to say. There's been very tight lips and very, even with the defense team that's supposed to be given access to exculpatory or any kind of evidence, they've been very unwilling to share any information. So it's hard to say. Jahar, guilty or innocent of the particular charges against him, I don't really know based on evidence that the government may or may not have. But It certainly appears, with all the indicators we've seen throughout this, that there is some sort of troubling cover-up afoot, whether it be related to their prior relationship with the brothers, or whether it's related to the fact that maybe they were following them around, and that maybe they knew he was more of an extremist than they're letting on, or was he some sort of an informant, which is something that's been very commonly done, particularly with, you know, these young men have multilingual mastery in multiple languages from rare regions of the world that not everybody could speak. I mean, you could certainly build a scenario where they would be valuable assets in the world of, well, spy versus spy.
Or they could be patsies, sort of like Lee Harvey Oswald, correct?
Well, I mean, that's entirely possible. Whether or not that's the case, I'm not sure. I don't want to really speculate too much on that. But there are a lot of troubling parallels between, say, Lee Harvey Oswald, for instance, and when he allegedly gunned down a police officer in the middle of the street next thing you know, the gloves come off, and all of a sudden law enforcement kick into high gear, and it's an absolute miracle that even one of them survived, having been being riddled with bullets. So there are a lot of troubling parallels, and whether or not it's the case.
Can you speak to, after Tamerlane was supposedly shot and then run over by his brother, you can see a picture of him online where he's naked and the police are standing around him. Do you have anything to add to that?
You know, I've seen it, and it is very interesting, to say the least. I tried to get information on it from various law enforcement agencies, and basically nobody will talk about it. They will not provide any information on, okay, so this gentleman was allegedly let go and not found not to be a suspect. Well, since it didn't have anything to do with the bombing, can we have some information on it? We don't need his name, but so there's nothing. They will not share any of this. Whether or not it was Tamerlane, it's hard to say. I'm not a facial recognition person. He certainly resembled him. He was strong and looked pretty similar build and all, but I really don't know what the story is on that. It is strange, again, the person has not come forward. You think that would be very newsworthy. He had absolutely nothing to be ashamed of. You know, it wasn't like he did anything embarrassing. So you would think he'd be interested to say, hey, I'm the guy that got apprehended accidentally.
Right. Let me ask you, James, why is knowing about what happened in the Boston Marathon important?
Well, it's important because it was the biggest terrorist attack since 9/11 to happen in our country. It's important because it, of course, justifies a lot of the ramping up of the police apparatus, and not just the police, but national security in general. You know, we're seeing results right now of allowing these agencies carte blanche to do things in secrecy without any accountability. And with the torture report that just came out, we're seeing probably the tip of the iceberg of how troubling it is when these institutions are not held accountable and not forced to operate in the light of day. It just breeds corruption and behavior like we saw with the torture stuff. So, you know, when then an event like this happens again, I think we all need to be careful in accepting law enforcement and the national security apparatus's version of events. We need to be highly skeptical of it. And we also need to realize that these are the events that are slowly eroding our control over our own government.
Right.
Sort of the outside threat thing is when people acquiesce any sort of control over their democracy.
Well, James Henry, unfortunately, we're out of time. I really want to thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me. I just want to remind listeners that you can follow Who, What, Why on Facebook and Twitter, and that Who, What, Why is a not-for-profit, nonpartisan news outlet.
Right, and the website is whowhatwhy.com. And again, that was a recent interview with James Henry of whowhatwhy.com. According to a recent poll, 4 in 10 Bostonians are skeptical of the official account of the Boston Marathon bombing. The trial of the younger brother, Jokar Sarnaev, is scheduled to begin on January 5th, 2015, in Boston. And on a final note today, in a recent article from the American Free Press by Ronald L. Ray, dated October 26, 2014, a German journalist, Dr. Udo Ulf Kote, has written a book called Gekaufte Journalisten, or literally, Bought Journalists. In the new bestseller, he reveals the rampant cooperation of the media with intelligence agencies, transatlantic organizations, banks, corporations, and billionaires. As of October 26th, when this article first appeared, the book was not out in English yet, but hopefully it is by now. It's certainly worth checking out. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.